Shall we get this show started? What a crowd. Thank you all for being here tonight. This is impressive on the night of the seventh game of the World Series. And so thank you all for taking the time. And what an experience. Thank you so much for all of the Tesla drivers. Who's here who brought their Teslas tonight? Show of hands. Yes, thank you. Wow, what an experience to go out and see what's possible. This panel came together because of a lot of hard work, and this whole event came because of a lot of hard work by some folks. And I want to just take a moment and recognize a few folks. Dr. Gene Sherritt, formerly ESD superintendent here, Washington Student Achievement Council. Thanks, Gene. From our Wenatchee Valley College, Stacy Lukensmeyer, put in a lot of work back in the back. Thanks, Stacy. We have Pat Jones and Laura Jakes from the Portage Land County. Are they here tonight? No. Oh, back here. Good to see you. We've got Randy Brooks from Plug In North Central Washington. So. And on the panel, and he's going to be on the panel, also on the panel, Rich Durock from Link Transit. And from Chelan PD, Steve Wright is going to be moderating and participating on the panel. So, Steve. So, tremendous opportunity when I spoke with Dr. Michael Kindermeyer, who I happen to know his wife went to high school with her here in Wenatchee. So we're delighted to have and welcome him back into the valley. And his mother-in-law is here, Mary. Welcome, and good to have you here, brother-in-law Mike. So we are delighted. Michael contacted me a few months ago, and we started talking about a presentation. He's been giving in other places. He is a scientist with Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And I'm going to read his biography because I tried to summarize this and regurgitate it, and I couldn't do it in an understandable manner. So pardon me for doing this. So he has 20 years of experience in energy, economics, and environment system analysis and modeling. He's an engineer by training, and he's managed U.S. and international teams on numerous projects involved in the aspects of system modeling for electric capacity expansion planning, optimal electric generation dispatch under security and emissions constraints, renewable energy resource assessments. You get the picture. An expert and spent many years understanding smart transportation and changes that are coming upon us in the energy and transportation fields. So this is a wonderful opportunity for us. Would you please help me welcome Dr. Michael Kindermeyer.
Thank you, Rufus. I'd like to take you on a journey here for the next 45 minutes that talks about smart transportation and unpacks smart transportation. You may have heard smart grid, smart home, smart cities. So what is smart transportation, and particularly how might it be actually relevant for you or for a community such as Wenatchee? But then I also like to talk about more specifically electric vehicles, which some people might say is sort of the nugget of smart transportation, but may not necessarily be it. And there are very nice synergies that are coming about there, and it's particularly driven because of the technology has become so cheap, where sensors become relatively cheap, where batteries are coming cheap, and where energy technology becomes very cheap. So we're seeing a convergence of several different technologies, IT technologies, information technologies, energy technologies, electric motors and sensors, but then also a battery technology. And so it's from a science and technology perspective, a really nice time to be in. And I'd like to particularly the younger folks really communicate to them is stay in school, work hard. There's a great future out there. So let me give you just a brief overview of the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. We're one of the best kept secrets there. A lot of our funders, Department of Energy, go to other national laboratories and not so much visiting us because we're a little bit hidden away. So we are one of the 17 US DOE-led national laboratories in the nation. You probably have heard of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and so forth. So we are located in Richland, Washington, but we have a Seattle office, we have a Portland, Oregon office, and we have the very unique Marine Sciences Laboratory in SQIM, SQIM, Washington. So we are entity, a non-for-profit entity. Battelle Memorial Institute is my employer. And we are operating the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory facility for the U.S. Department of Energy. Most of the funding comes from the Department of Energy, but we also have some significant funding sources there from the Department of Homeland Security and other federal entity, as well as commercial, commercial partners. So you're seeing here a couple of statistics. I think one of the things that really makes PNNL unique is that we're trying to take science from the very theoretical side, applying it to a certain area, and then use the engineering capabilities to really move the needle to create impact. But to give you one example there, what I'm working on is battery, a battery technology. So it takes really top-notch electrochemists that work on the material side to advance the material science, to understand what's the degradation in the current batteries that make the batteries fail. What does it take to drive the cost down from the materials purchasing perspective, from the manufacturing perspective, such that we have the prices that we like to have to afford an electric vehicle at the price point somewhere in the mid at $20,000. So it also takes then the engineers that says is a vehicle, a battery in a vehicle has to have certain weight properties. It has to have certain properties of utilizing it. And if you can really do it right and you would like to have another market there, the way Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla Motor Corporation, is thinking about is, can you take the same battery and apply it for grid application? And indeed, that is what Elon Musk is doing right now, helping out our brothers and sisters there in Puerto Rico with some solar cells and some batteries to provide emergency generation for a hospital before the utility companies come and restore the grid power. So let me jump right into the topic for tonight, that is transportation. And I'd like to frame transportation more than just a wheel, a frame, an engine, and some electronics to make it work, but rather define it as mobility. That is, how do we, in the 21st century, want to move freight and persons around so that we can prosper, that we can grow, and that we can maintain our lifestyle. And so it takes various different forms. It's personal transportation, as you see here. It's aviation, it's public transportation, it's shipment. All of that stuff has to be looked at it from an overall optimization perspective. And there are different technologies fitting into different needs. And so if you look at overall at transportation, it's really a large part of our energy economy and a large part of our household expenses. So it's number two on average in the United States as a household expense after housing. You see the number there. If you look at overall from the statistics of where energy is used nationwide, you're seeing that transportation is the second largest grouping after electricity. So way larger, we are using way more energy for transporting goods and people than we use for heating and air conditioning buildings and homes. So the proportion of this energy is broken up into about 55% gasoline, 21% diesel, then jet fuel, and then some of the biofuels. So there are different trends that are shaping these mobility needs. So it's primarily driven by population. So we're seeing migration patterns in the United States from rural areas to these 11 metro centers. So these metro centers that you're seeing on the map are linked together by road and rail infrastructure, but also by economic dependencies. And so they are growing larger and larger in size and drawing from immigrants as well as from people in rural areas. And if you see here the projection from about today to 2040 by the Census Bureau, you're seeing there that there is a decline in rural population and people will move to urban areas and suburban areas. So we can expect that the mobility needs in these areas will be even increased further as we're moving out into the mid-century time. So as these demands in these urban areas and suburban areas grow, we can expect more congestion. These are the figures for today's congestion figures. So on average, that is cumulative time wasted, people standing in traffic, in slow traffic or stop and go traffic is about 7 billion hours, that's cumulative. Burning about 3 billion gallons of fuels for running the radio and the air conditioning or the heater. And that totals up about $160 billion of basically waste. So there are policy changes that drive these mobility trends. And so you're seeing here, those are the different CAFE standards. So those are efficiency standards for light duty vehicles expressed in CAFE, which stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy standards. And you're seeing there 19 miles a gallon in 1979. And so in 2025, it goes up as high as 54. And so that is combined a truck and light duty vehicles. And so what does that really mean from a perspective of revenues there on the gasoline taxes? That you're seeing erosion there on the revenues coming in into state coffers for road construction and road improvements. And so we're seeing here a projection for Washington State done by Washington State Transportation Commission, and that is the revenues per miles driven is expected to go down because of the higher efficiencies. So something has to be offset, right? And so there are currently some interesting pilot studies going on in the Seattle area and Vancouver, BC area, and the analog is actually happening in Oregon, that looks at road use charge. Various different technologies, as simple as tell me what the odometer reading is to GPS control. So where you don't really need to do anything, it radios straight back to the department or to an aggregator, and that goes then to the Department of Transportation. So historically, we have seen their technology being applied. Again, that drives the energy consumption and the overall driving behavior and driving experience. So if you're seeing here from 1950 to today, There's lots of technology that's introduced, ABS, lightweighting, seeing here, seat airbags. So primarily geared toward improvement of safety as well as energy efficiency. And so you're seeing here technology goes hand in hand with some new regulations because we can do it, and therefore we regulate it. For instance, seat belts or airbags are now regulated as a must-have technology because it becomes cost-effective. So looking forward into the future there, we're expecting much more connectivity. So that means that vehicles are talking to infrastructure. Vehicles talking to vehicles. For instance, if there is a stranded vehicle, it will communicate to vehicles that are just approaching the location is, be aware, you know, I'm stranded, I'm blocking the road. And so it's particularly important if you come over a hill, you don't see it, you're driving pretty fast, you know, you avoid a collision. So what we're seeing here, also different cars. So for congestion management, particularly in urban areas, you have a lot of single occupancy driving, and there's nothing more wasteful than having a half a ton or three quarter ton truck moving one person. And that's probably what happens early in the morning here when people go to work, and in the evening when they come back. So here's the alternative. You know, that keeps you out in the rain, and it's very light, and you can drive side by side probably three cars in one. And here's the Elon Musk bullet train there, sort of in transit rapid transit system that is conceived to be as fast, maybe faster, to go from downtown San Diego to downtown San Francisco on this vacuum tube with this bullet going 500 miles an hour or so. So there are also demographics that play a role in transportation. So we here in the United States, we live longer. These are some of the projections as far as the age distribution is concerned between today in black and in 2040. So what you're seeing is a significant growth, 7% of a growth for people 65 and older. So now the question becomes is, some of whom of this population there has some mobility limits. And so can we extend the independence of folks there by having more technology in the vehicle so that they can drive themselves to the dentist, they can drive themselves to the physician, do some shopping, you know, without having somebody else driving them. So it would be a big, big advantage. So we're seeing there that actually the extension, and that's some of the people what they forecast, is that some of the vehicle miles traveled by the older folks there will actually increase with new technology. Counterweighting there are the millennials, right? And so how do they connect with each other? They don't hop in a car and hang out at somebody else's friend's house. No, they're connecting, you know, with cell phones. So we actually have seen is that the vehicle miles traveled in that particular population is actually going down. So we had to actually force my son to get the driver's license because mother wouldn't drive him, you know, to swim classes there. And it's just a different mentality. So the question now becomes is, you have the new population maybe driving less, and you have another population maybe driving more. So where will the entire population, where will it work out in terms of congestion management in urban areas? So how will the mobility and the driving habits change in urban areas? And so the Department of Energy made an analysis, and I'd like to go a little bit deeper into this here because it's noteworthy. So you get a bunch of scientists together and you're saying, what's your best bet in terms of total consumption for mobility in the United States, given the new technology? And so some are saying it's gonna go up. twofold. That's the 200. And others might say, I could also see a scenario where it actually is going down, where technology is improving, efficiency is improving, maybe not the ownership. Everybody has a vehicle and you do more sharing, ride sharing, and it actually could go down by. So now the fan of possibilities, given the expert judgments, can be from plus 200% to minus 60%. So take your guess, right? But let me introduce some of the reasoning there, what really went on. So you're seeing up here in this chart here, the 200%. So this was the base case, you know, zero efficiency improvements. And so what people were thinking is that the easy traveling with self-driving vehicles may actually substitute people making decisions to use an airplane. So for instance, if I want to go from the Tri-Cities to Portland, I have to go through Seattle, wait there at least an hour, labor time, I have to deal with TSA in the Tri-Cities, and I have to get out of the airport. So if I had the self-driving car and I would say, Siri, take me to Portland. And then I lean back, I read the newspaper, have a Starbucks coffee, and it takes me there. I snooze, I make a phone call. You know, it might actually be faster than taking the airplane. So likewise, people were saying look, in Seattle, with $20 or $25 parking charges, I might tell my vehicle, go get lost. Find yourself a place there and come back at 4 o'clock to pick me up. So this would be much more driving, you know, and again, you probably have a little algorithm that says it's cheaper to drive around and come back at 4 than paying $25 for the parking garage. So this is where this notion came about. And so that is what, and I think the jury is still out there. And it makes really some of the transportation planners, we've talked with the transportation planners in Seattle and in Portland, really nervous from a safety perspective, from a congestion perspective, and then also from an emission perspective. Okay, so let me move on. Couple of key drivers there towards smart transportation. So we usually look at these categories of drivers. So they're regulatory perspectives, regulatory drivers, that's reduction fatalities and accidents, managing congestion, environmental constraints, all of that drives toward being more efficient, maybe even less driving. And then you're seeing market forces there that really prepare the new technology. People want to have the new technology. It's cool to have it. There are new services being provided. And you're seeing here some of the real economic drivers in a minute. So let me walk through each of these and unpack them. So the first one is fatalities. So this is a graph by the National Highway Traffic Safety Association, for short, NHTSA. And that is the number of fatalities total in the United States in years. So we have been hovering around 30 to 50,000 per year. Those are fatalities associated with traffic. Of those, 94 are caused by human failure, to a total of close to 900 billion per year. So the bodily injury costs there amount about 500 to 600 billion, and the rest is property damage. So that's what we're raking up every year. And so consulting companies are saying with self-driving autonomous vehicles and other technologies that you can probably drive this down to about 10%, so 90% reduction by mid-century. So there is, at least directionally, I think they are correct. There's the expectation that new technology will prevent you from falling asleep or it will actually drive by itself, distance, holding distance, and some of these newer technologies to which I will come in a minute. Congestion management. So this is actually in LA. So sitting in traffic. So what do we do about it? So there are commonly these five different strategies, right? Road expansion, multimodal transportation, pricing, congestion pricing, smart growth, and then traffic demand and routing management. So widening the road, that has been done typically I-5 corridor, I-90 corridor in Seattle. This will provide short-term relief, but then you build it and people will come. And so you have then, again, the congestion because you're inviting the demand and the growth by widening the road. So the next one is multimodal. So this is the concept of you take your bicycle or you take a ride share and you take it to the metro. The metro takes us somewhere and then you have smooth transition. Either there's a bike waiting for you, you take that. So it's multimodal and it's all made very smooth, very elegant using your cell phone. So this would require really human shift in human behavior. Are we going to do it? Don't know. Would it make a big difference? We don't know. But people are working on it. So you're going to Portland, you're going to Seattle, so there are these services already. But let me go into smart growth, and this is really what is a major concern there in the Seattle area. So in Seattle, all of the growth and all of the development of infrastructure, as far as transportation is concerned, is done by the Puget Sound Regional Transportation Planning Council. And so they're projecting what is the population growth, and here we're seeing they're up to 2040. They're expecting in the greater Puget Sound area about 1 million additional people with 850,000 additional jobs, requiring new business offices, and 600,000 additional households. So multifamily or single family homes. Where are you going to put them? How do you structure them to interconnect them to the major transport line, whether it's I-5, I-90, light rail, what have you? And so people are really thinking about how do you now use modern technologies so that you don't lock in a mortgage there of infrastructure that's really, really difficult to change. There's lots of simulation. We're helping with big number crunching capabilities, some of these planning councils. And then there is a central signal systems that is routing management. And so you're seeing this in Seattle already. So in the morning, I-5 corridor, the express lane is toward downtown, and in the evening it reverses going back. And so there's just indicated by these crosses or by these red check marks there that indicates the drivers which way they can go. So there is ramp metering, signal controls that will sequence the signals so that you get more throughput. So that's already being done. Now this will be all enhanced there with much more understanding of what is the situational awareness on intersection and will be resolved locally and can then be supervised from some of these central controls. So think of this as air traffic control. So there is some autonomous resolutions there at the intersection, but then also supervisory control if there's a Seahawk game, it ends and you want to flush everybody out, you know, then you're directing the signals accordingly. So let me now come to some of the emissions, and I'm doing a little detour here again. And I will be talking about two kinds of emissions. One is more global emissions, which is the greenhouse gases. So they manifest themselves just cumulative over the entire globe. Then I will talk about some local emissions there, which will also drive technology. So greenhouse gas emission reductions. So you all heard in the newspaper, a radio, that 2015 was the big event in Paris, where 192 countries signed up for the Paris Agreement, and the current administration rescinded from it. However, there are states and cities that said, we are taking on charge to do emissions reductions regardless. And actually, that trend happened already simultaneously as the IPCC, so that's the UN delegation, the International Panel for Climate Change, on the national level, worked the agreements from nation to nation. You saw in parallel track that cities and states or provinces pledged to be also on track, regardless of what the national governments were doing. And so you're seeing here, worldwide, there's a trend and bottom-up trend. And so here in Washington State, and that is cut out, Washington, May 2015, Governor Inslee signed what's called the Under 2 Degrees MOU to declare that we, as the state of Washington, pledge to bring our greenhouse gases 80% below 1990 value. So what does it mean? This is what's currently in the books here. So Washington State current law says that in 2035, the greenhouse gases will be 25% below 1990 values, and in 2050, 50%. But now with this MOU, it's gonna be much more drastic, right? So this is the pathway. That's what the governor indicated. So what does it really mean? How do you really implement this in laws and then in regulations? So this is an overall a picture there of greenhouse gas emission by sectors. On top is United States as a whole. Transportation makes up 26%. Washington State down here, 46%, because we have a fairly clean electricity system already. So if you want to bring down the greenhouse gases, you got to work on transportation. That's the big challenge. That's a big challenge for Washington. That's a big challenge for Oregon. So last year, the governor commissioned a study that says, is what are the potential pathways to drive you down? One of them was electrification of transportation. Not just surprising, right? So you're driving out fuels, the fuel components that has the carbon, and you're using primarily hydrofuel and other renewables to drive the new fleet of electric vehicles. And so two key things to take away. Number one is, so this is the base case. So this is, if we don't do anything, this is the total energy here in 2050. This is with the electrification to drive down the emission. So that means is that we will have a much lower energy footprint. So a lot of more energy efficiency in all sectors. So we're seeing particularly on the fuel side, gasoline shrinks down, diesel fuel shrinks down, natural gas shrinks down. What's going up? Electricity is going up. And so where's the electricity coming from? According to these projections, more wind. Hydro stays pretty much the same. Not more water expected to come down, and no more hydropower plants, and solar and geothermal. So that's the new resource. But the takeaway message really is a shift in transportation from the current fuels, fossil fuels, to with electric. So let me now come to sort of the more localized emissions. And so I'm taking you a little bit outside, again, the home turf, and even outside the United States. So you all recall the Dieselgate, right, with VW, As a matter of fact, it was a professor at West Virginia University, small university, very small grant from the EPA. So he put some sensors into a VW diesel vehicle and said, well, I just want to measure it, just driving around. So he drove around West Virginia, Petersburg, and said, gee, you know, compared the results there, what he got, with what the results that he's supposed to get from the data sheet. There's a big mismatch. And so he reported it up the line to EPA. And that's how the whole thing came about. There was a professor there in West Virginia. And so heads at the highest level at VW in Germany started to roll. Big, big implication. Now, the implication of this is, so you're seeing here, is that meanwhile, mayors of major cities, Stuttgart, that is the Detroit of Germany, the home of Mercedes and Porsche. So indoor air quality bad because of lots of light duty vehicles being diesel. The mayor said, and he got, it was a court ruling, there's no more diesels after 2030 in Stuttgart. But at the same time, you're getting some pronouncement from the highest level of government in Britain, banning sales of gasoline diesel vehicles 2040. France, ending sales of gasoline vehicles 2040. India must sell electric vehicles. Norway, clear targets there for electric vehicles. So that takes you a little bit, again, out of the home turf, but it's indicative of where some of the trends lie. And so you're seeing here that in Portland, forward-leaning city, they too are really recognizing all the health effects with gasoline-driven vehicles. So they are in an EPA non-attainment zone. That means certain times during the year, they don't meet their clean air standards. And it's because of traffic. And so you're seeing the same thing in Seattle. Seattle is primarily caused there by the ferry boats and the Big Harbor traffic. So let me now switch over to some of the business drivers. So I talked about regulatory drivers there before. Now I go to some of the business cases there. So autonomous vehicle, it's very, very compelling for large trucks, long haul trucks. And so all of the big companies, Kenmore, Packard, Mercedes, they're all in it. They're all in it. And so they're already estimating huge benefits. They are higher fuel efficiency, lower maintenance costs, driver satisfaction, or even reduction of personnel altogether, where you don't really have to have a driver, or you're doing what is seems to be so the first implementation of autonomous vehicles would be convoy, where you have 5-6 trucks that are following each other, where only the front truck is one driver. The others are electronically linked. So we're also seeing, and this is really, experimentations are going on in Nevada, primarily with big trucks there. And so you're seeing there are really strong releases there by these major truck companies there that this technology will come about in 2020 or mid-2020. So this has huge implication there on the workforce. So where trucker, owner, operator there is still sort of a good job, well-paying job, this will have significant implications. Transportation as a service. So we all know the Ubers, the Lyft. This is a phenomenon worldwide. So you're seeing all these companies. So we may recognize only these two, others are niche markets, but this is a phenomenon. You go to Europe, you go to Asia, this is blossoming as we speak, growing by leaps and bounds. So let me shed a little bit of light on how do we really categorize these self-driving cars. And it's a the spectrum, right? So we have already cruise control, which is the level one. So the Society of Automotive Engineers has five categories, from driving yourself, that is level zero, to fully autonomous driving there, that would be the little beetle-like looking car from Google that you're seeing, where it doesn't even have a steering wheel, has no paddles. You're just talking to it and saying, take me to place number X, or take me somewhere. So level one, driver continuously exercising longitudinal and lateral control. So you're still on the steering wheel, but you have cruise control. So the cruise control is keeping the distance. That's pretty much it. So if you're going to level two, and that's actually classified by NHTSA, the Federal Highway Transportation Safety Administration, is a level two. So it still, it allows temporarily hands off. So some of you have tested it out. So you cannot really go fully hands off from here to Seattle University of Washington Husky Stadium. So if you take off the hands for too long, the system will actually tell you you must put your hands back on, or it'll go into a safe mode and go over to the right hand lane, stop, and starts blinking and calling 911 and saying you need some help. So it goes then to the next level here, and further automation there to the point where it's fully autonomous. And so again, these realizations here in this area will be happening very soon, so within the next 3 to 5 years. So this gives you just a quick overview of technology to be expected in the showroom here in Wenatchee. And so you're looking at some of the investments. I categorize, and I don't want to go through all of this, but the bottom line is all of the US manufacturers, all of the Asians, all of the Europeans are in it. And you're seeing their R&D efforts, research and development funding efforts in the billions. So this is serious. This is serious. And so you will see there, probably starting in 2020 and then mid-20s, there are products out there that will migrate from the level one to the level four, maybe five. So some, here's another sheet. Some naysayers will say as well, but I always like to drive this. Yep, you will always have the choice there to have your Mustang there for the V8. So let me switch gears there and talk about electric vehicles, and let me wrap this up quickly. So this is a chart here about a chart of registration of electric vehicles by years by vehicles in Washington State. And so what you're seeing there is the Nissan Leaf is the most popular one, right? Because it's more affordable, but then you're also seeing sort of the Teslas there, and then BMW and others. But the takeaway message is, if I show you the acceleration from year to year and compare it to hybrid electric vehicles of the kind of the Toyota Priuses, this growth rate is actually faster nationally and faster here in Washington State. So whatever we know about the introduction of the Priuses and the hybrid electric vehicles, this is going fast. So where are we here in Chelan County? This is as of June 2017, 105. So we are sort of in the mid-range. If you divide it by population, you're still in the mid-range. Not too surprising, the highest number of electric vehicles per capita is in San Juan. Surprising, right? Because you cannot really drive all that. Nissan Leaf will do it. So what's the infrastructure requirements if you want to charge a vehicle? So this is your level one, called level one, level that is 120 volts that plugs in all of these NEMA outlets. This is a level two that is special customized. That's on the charging stations. You can also have it in your garage. And then we have in the next one a DC charger, a fast charger that is meant for doing cross-country driving. So you have, for instance, one of those at Sankadia. You have those in Ellensburg, close somewhere out in the rest stop. I've just seen one on Cascade Locks on the way to Portland in the middle of, you know, small town. There's a Starbucks there, there's a charging. So this will allow you to charge it up, a Nissan Leaf from fully empty to full in about 30 minutes. So and then there are some wireless charging. The benefits is you don't have to think about it rolling the garage and plugging it in, right? You just roll over a pad and it charges very similar to your electric toothbrush. And then some people are saying is, well, can I do it dynamically here in the roadway? And the British are working on this. So the intent here is you're putting the money in the infrastructure rather than in the vehicle. So this allows you to do continuous driving there with a relatively small battery because you're charging as you're going along. Disadvantage is, costs a lot of upfront money. So this is the infrastructure here, and you can go to this www.plugshare.com website, and you're seeing all these publicly accessible charging stations. So if I want to go from the Tri-Cities to a Husky game in Seattle, and I only have a Nissan Leaf with a range of, say, 70 miles, I go to Prosser, I go to Yakima, I go to Allensburg, I go to Clallam, I go to Snoqualmie Pass, North Bend, and then Husky. So I could do it. There is significant interest by the state to build out this infrastructure. And so the question now is, how do you finance it? What's the business case? The business case to induce the necessary private capital to engage in infrastructure. It's clear that the commodity sold, the kilowatt hour, is not getting there. The electricity is too darn cheap. So there are challenges in the build out. So let me finally talk about so the five reasons why you should think about investing in electric vehicle next time around when you're in the business of electric vehicles. So I give you five motivations, five reasons. Number one, lowest total cost of ownership today. So again, some of the DOE National Laboratories looked at all of these different vehicles there and came up there with a battery electric vehicle, 100 miles range is the lowest drive, will realize the lowest total cost and ownership. So that would be purchasing the vehicle, driving the vehicle, maintaining the vehicle, and then reselling. So that gives you the lowest cost solution. Excellent performance. So for those of you who like big torque, there's nothing better than electric vehicle. So look at the torque curve here. It's the highest in standstill, right? So on your Mustang there, you got to rev it up here and to get it to that a torque. So it's, as far as pickup is concerned, there's nothing more, that's nothing faster. So for those of you who want to really see a side-by-side comparison, there's a YouTube video out there where one of those SUVs, Tesla SUVs that you've seen outside, doing a side-by-side 0 to 60, or it goes even 0 to 80 against the Lamborghini. Guess who wins? Yes. Good for the environment. So particularly here in Chelan, so clean hydropower, so there's no upstream pollution and no tailpipe. So from a wheel, from a well-to-wheel perspective, it's clean. It's good for the grid. We did some analysis that looked at how can actually electric vehicles be synergetic with the grid. And so the grid operators have some challenges with the adoption there of wind power, and we're seeing particularly down at the gorge, you driving down Goldendale toward Portland, you're seeing lots of windmills. And so it actually happens when the wind blows, all of these machines are turning and producing electricity. And so we're seeing in some situations there that within half an hour, all of those megawatts will actually go down and can go down to a minimal percentage. And so something else has to then be able to offset this reduction. And we demonstrated this technically to do it with electric vehicles. You can do it with power plants and the hydro dams, you know, very good to do it, but you can also do it with electric vehicles. So, and the final point is, it's really cool technology and will be part of the future. This is sort of a quick portfolio of what you can do. I particularly like this thing here, and I know that Jim White has a Zero motorcycle there. I'm eyeing for one of those as well. I still have my BMW there that pollutes. So I want to leave you with this final thought there. And that is, I talked a lot about the future of how to project it. The best way to really predict the future is to create it. And so this is the final thought that I want to leave, particularly here for the younger folks who are thinking about what are they going to do when they grow up. So working on some of these challenges will be a very rewarding job. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Michael. And I'm guessing you have many questions for Michael. I'm going to ask you to hold them for a second. We're going to now turn this to a local flavor and talk a little bit about electric vehicles here in Chelan County and what it means. We're going to start with Richard Durock, who's the head of Link Transit. Very successful, has more than doubled the ridership in Chelan County here in the last 15 years. So Richard, you're up.
Back in 2006, the legislature passed a law requiring that all publicly owned vehicles in the state be powered with renewable fuels by 2018. Renewables are defined as electric, propane, natural gas, or biofuel. So we started looking at this issue back in 2006, figuring, well, how do we go down that path? Biofuels don't really work in our climate. They gel, they turn into a solid when it gets below 26 degrees. And no one's really figured that issue out in a diesel mode. Petroleum in terms of gasoline, it actually has higher emissions. It's a real challenge from a variety of standpoints. So we didn't want to go down that path. Natural gas is a great fuel for transit. Our pipeline's not big enough. To run natural gas here, we would have to replace the pipeline from Ellensburg all the way over to the valley. That's hundreds of millions of dollars to do that. Clearly wasn't economical to do that. Propane works. In fact, we've done our light duty fleet on propane. Propane's been a really big win for us. We've converted all our gasoline-powered vehicles to propane. Propane currently sells for 53 cents a gallon. The federal government gives us a 50-cent tax credit, which means I'm paying 3 cents a gallon for fuel. The vehicles we converted to propane, our minivans, the little ones that do our paratransit, we were the first ones in the world to do propane on that engine. So we had to send our vehicles to the EPA to have them certified. The EPA lab down in Roosevelt called us back and said, we don't know what to do. What do you mean we don't know what to do? Said the emissions out of the tailpipe are less than the air coming in the air cleaner in the front end. They actually have certified them as a negative emission vehicle. So they actually clean the air as they drive. Now, they still have greenhouse gases, but it's 20% less than gasoline. So even on that, it's a win. So that's been a real positive. But propane isn't available for heavy-duty vehicles. And so we started looking at electric, and we got lucky. In 2009, as part of the stimulus package, the federal government put out a request for transit agencies that were willing to experiment with electric. And there were about 50 of us that applied. There were three awarded grants for electric vehicles. One went to Los Angeles, one went to Flint, Michigan, and one went to Wenatchee. So So, and actually the Flint never happened and the LA project failed. So we're the only successful one that came out of that. Success is an interesting question on that. In 2009, this technology for a heavy duty vehicle was really new. Now, part of the reason we went electric was this state mandate. The other part was electricity's cheaper. And I had worked on electric vehicles in Los Angeles before I came to Wenatchee. And in LA, it didn't make sense. The power was too expensive. You could not make an economic argument that it made sense. Here, with the lower rates, it had a real potential to actually be cheaper than diesel fuel, as well as buying you the environmental benefits. And so we were willing to take a risk, particularly when the federal government was willing to pay the capital cost. And we got a $3.2 million grant that first year to do that. We were breaking lots and lots of ground on these vehicles, and it took us a long time to get there. We actually went through three different battery technologies, three different charging technologies, but we actually did meet all the goals we set for the project. There are these green trolleys that operate in downtown currently. They were designed to be a vehicle that had a certain capacity in the battery, and then we would charge it when it was pulling to our station to extend the range so that the vehicle could operate all day. And we did that for about a year and a half. Our vendor could never get our fast charger to not cause the batteries to fail. And so we were replacing batteries about one a week. Batteries are not that expensive, but it takes a day and a half to replace a battery in a bus. And there's 190 of them on the vehicle, so you're constantly moving through that. So we ended up turning our fast chargers off. And we're just running them on a slow charge basis now, and that's working. But it means they'll only run half a day. We get about 65 miles out of the vehicle before we have to bring it back to the yard to charge them. So we're using the equipment. We learned a tremendous amount, and it moved the technology quite a bit. In 2011, we got a second grant. In fact, we've gotten three grants for electric vehicles. We're the only system in the United States that's done that because we delivered, which is pretty positive. Our second grant was for five plug-in full-size coaches, and these are on the road today. These are our BYD transit coaches. We have five of them in service. They are a Chinese company. BYD is the largest battery manufacturer in the world. Your cell phone all has BYD batteries in them. The company, though, has built an American plant, and these are built actually in California. So they're American. They're technically American product. The technology is pretty darn amazing. The vehicle in the 5 years from our first generation bus to our second generation bus, our first generation bus has batteries, 192 batteries on it. They have 90 kilowatts of power. Our 2016 BYDs have 155 batteries on them. And if you've noticed, the BYD is a 35-foot coach that weighs 38,000 pounds. The little trolleys are a 22-foot vehicle that weighs 15,000 pounds, so you have fewer batteries, but they have 270 kilowatts of power in them. Smaller battery, actually lighter than the batteries in the first generation bus. The technology is moving incredibly fast on the batteries. Those vehicles, after getting through our initial startup issues, are working quite well. We get about 135-mile range out of the vehicle. 270 kilowatts, that means you get about two kilowatts per mile, what it takes us to operate that vehicle. That's actually a good number for a heavy-duty vehicle. But 135-mile range is not very long. Our shortest route is 128 miles. So that is a real challenge. And most of our routes are like 200 miles. So they don't really work for most things we do. And they certainly don't work on our long-distance route. We have one bus that runs to and from Chelan that does 412 miles a day. So you're certainly not going to do that with a bus with 135-mile range. Currently, what we're doing with our buses is we pull them in about halfway through the day, and we plug them in for an hour and charge them up. Our slow charger on these vehicles is an 85-kilowatt charger. It'll put a third of the entire battery capacity back in an hour, which by any definition for cars would be exceedingly fast. And that works, but it requires us to replace that bus for an hour. So it requires two buses instead of one. So it has a higher cost. It has to have a driver to drive the replacement bus while the bus is charging. That's working. We have a third grant that we're just starting on for five more buses. Same bus, but but these buses will have wireless charging. And not just wireless like the picture of the small car. That wireless charger that they showed the picture of is a 3 kilowatt wireless charger. Our wireless charger is 200 kilowatts. And it's going to start installation 2 weeks from now. That's going to be installed at Columbia Station. That'll be the first in the world over a 50 kilowatt wireless charger. There's some smaller ones that are operating in Monterey and in Howard County, Maryland right now, but we're going to end up with the first large charger. That'll put 3 kilowatts of power back into the bus per minute, which means we can charge it while passengers are getting off and on at the station. And if we can get 5 minutes every time the bus is in the station of charge time on the vehicle, that'll allow us to run that bus on nearly any route. The system gets about 270 to 300 mile range out of that vehicle. If we put a charger at both ends, the one up in Leavenworth, one up in Chelan, we can actually do the long route. So we expect to be testing that technology January of this year. And the decision whether we go forward on that, our board, we've scheduled April as our deadline to make the decision whether to go forward, because it doesn't make sense for us to buy 5 more plug-in vehicles. They don't work in our system without doing the midday charging. But if we can get the wireless charging, then that'll make a lot of sense going forward. So that actually means we are really aggressive on electric vehicles. I've actually got the highest percentage of electric vehicles of any transit system in the United States right now in our fleet. And our maintenance staff definitely feels it. Community loves them. I actually believe this technology is going to become very dominant. Not just because of the energy and the emission savings, which are extraordinary. I think communities are going to demand them because they're quiet. The ambient noise off an electric vehicle is 48% lower than a diesel vehicle. I think neighborhoods are just going to demand electric vehicles. That's also one of the nice things of propane. It's actually cheaper than gas. It's actually quieter than gasoline. They both have a lower cost. One of the questions was asked was, what are the barriers to electrification? And there's some huge ones. There's ones that we're just starting to understand going forward. Infrastructure, the electrical infrastructure to our facilities is a huge challenge. When we got this second grant, we were putting in our slow chargers, so our overnight chargers at our terminal. And we said, let's go ahead and plumb in the wiring for the entire fleet if that's what we want to do. So if the cost of conduit and so forth is cheap, we won't put the chargers in, but let's do that. Working with the PUD, we can't do that. There's not enough power to the facility to do that. And the cost of the additional transformers to do that would have been $8 or $9 million, more than the buses cost. So we have power that'll handle 29 buses. That's about half of my fleet. So that's probably the upper limit of what we can do without having a significant infrastructure cost to make that work. The other issue is something that we've again been talking about, is demand charges. When you charge a bus, you're charging it quickly for a short period of time. That spikes your demand piece on the system, and there are charges. While our base rate is very low, demand charges actually add quite a bit to it. What we've been seeing is our cost per kilowatt is not the 2.3, 2.7 cents that we say we have. It's about 12 and a half cents a kilowatt when you figure the demand charges into it. That puts us back up to the national average for electrical cost. Now, it's still cheaper than anybody else in terms of demand charge, but it is a lot more expensive. And at that cost, the cost of operating an electric vehicle is about 95% of what a diesel bus does. Plus, we have to take the risk of operating technology that no one's ever run before. Don't know if it's going to last the full 12 years. We don't know if it's going to pay back additional cost. Electric bus is the ones we have here are $743,000 a piece. That's about a $200,000 upcharge over what a diesel bus costs. So that economics is not quite as solid as it looks. Theoretically, it'll reduce maintenance costs. Theoretically, it's going to reduce the cost of brakes and other things because the regeneration does that. We didn't see that on our first generation buses. Their maintenance costs were actually higher. But we're pretty optimistic the second generation buses are actually going to deliver those things. So that's an interesting challenge. This state is committed to moving things forward, but they haven't gone as far as, say, California has. Electrification in transit world is huge. Just got back from the International Transit Conference in Atlanta months ago, and every single manufacturer's got electric vehicles now. 3 years ago, the last time this conference was held, there were maybe two manufacturers of electric vehicles, and the one before there was one. So things have changed. Now, there's lots of people claiming they have electric vehicles. Not entirely sure they're going to work the way they are. And people that have made the commitment to go larger are really facing some real challenges. A friend of mine runs the Antelope Valley Transit Authority in Lancaster. That happens to be where BYD built their plant. And because the plant is in that city, the city decided they're going to make their transit system 100% electric. And they're going to do it by 2018. A very aggressive goal. They have 83 buses. Their cost of upgrading their infrastructure to charge 83 buses was $14 million. And the amount of power that's coming into the facility, it's so hot, they couldn't bury it. It had to be in an open trench with a cover over because it generates much heat. So a very different design structure. When you're moving the amount of energy you have to do in a bus, that's a huge challenge. And those of us that were doing these small-scale demonstrations, and there's been a number of us around the country, hadn't faced that, because when you're doing one or two, that fits into the existing infrastructure. When you start scaling it up to, King County has committed to 712 electric buses. Talking to their maintenance people, they are scared stiff. Not one of their facilities has less than 200 buses, and not one of them has as much power as we have at our facility here. So they have no idea how they're going to get there. But their board is just saying, we're going to go down that path. So there's real limitations on the heavy duty market in terms of what this stuff does. This technology is still very new. Autonomous vehicles. In our industry, people say, you know, bus driving, that's a job that's going to disappear. The vehicle's going to drive themselves. And I actually think that's completely ridiculous. Not because I don't think the technology works. It's darn close. And the challenges that are left are more policy and regulatory than they are technologically. It's going to be, how do you insure an autonomous vehicle? How do you deal with the first time something fails? That's going to be the bigger challenges going forward. But think about our social system we have out there. I don't think autonomous vehicles work for a bus, because would any of you get on a vehicle that doesn't have an operator in it, where you don't know who else is on the vehicle? Our operators are not only drivers, they're also the security for the bus. They give you a sense of confidence. And the ability to get in a shared vehicle with someone you don't know, particularly if you happen to be a female, I'm not trying to be crazy, but sensitivity issues are there. If you don't know who else is on that vehicle and it's controlling itself so you can't open the doors and get out, you're not going to do it. It's just not going to happen. So it might be an autonomous vehicle, but there's going to be an attendant on it. Or there's going to be security systems that go to a higher level. Someone else told me, well, paratransit, or service for the disabled, will really change. And the same thing's true. By definition, people that use those special small vehicles, they've been evaluated, and they can't ride a bus by themselves. So how are they going to get from their house to the bus without an attendant? The same issue. So autonomous is going to come, but it's not necessarily going to change as much as we think right away. It's going to change, huge social change, before that'll happen. Those are some of the comments we have, and I'm going to move it over to our next.
So thanks. Next up is Randy Brooks. He's been a real leader here in the Valley with respect to electric vehicles. Plug-in Northwest has converted some of his own vehicles from gas to electric. So Randy?
Well, good evening. First, I want to thank all the Tesla owners who brought their cars tonight, just showed up and gave people rides. I mean, that was awesome. We had over 80 people take rides in our vehicles, so thank you. Well, Plug-in North Central Washington is kind of a unique organization. We are an all-volunteer nonprofit under the umbrella of the North Central Washington Economic Development District. And our goal is to encourage electric vehicle tourism to North Central Washington. And we do that by encouraging electrification of all forms of transportation, and by hosting or coordinating the installation of charging stations at host locations, businesses, and municipalities throughout North Central Washington. So far in the last 4 years, we've installed 21 charging stations throughout North Central Washington. All the major routes into and out of North Central Washington are now accessible by a small battery electric vehicle. And we've had over 2,000 charging sessions on those vehicles in that time, and offset more than 67,000 pounds of CO2 emissions. So I really like this quote right here. Our committee is made up of about 7 people. And like I said, we're all volunteers. And we want to see this future, and we are creating it. We are an incredible group of people who problem solve. You know, Lyon County PUD is not allowed by state law to gift electricity, so they can't have free electric vehicle chargers at their location. We figured out a way to get around that. They charge us for the power. We get donations from people. Cascade Auto donated funds, and we pay for that power so they can provide free charging stations. Over in New Halem on Highway 20, also, you know, they wanted to have an electric vehicle charger, so we loaned them one when they couldn't get their chargers going because they wanted to do credit card swiping, which costs more than the electricity involved. We sold them at a discount that charger, and it's available to the public. So we work to solve problems and make things happen. And that's what really turns me on about this organization. So getting to the questions that were presented to us, what's the greatest barrier to increased use of electric vehicles? I think really education. I think the people that came here today and saw what's possible and rode in an electric car that's really a neat vehicle, they're gonna, instead of just buying another gas vehicle, they're gonna say, hey, maybe we should check that out. And I know that you will find an electric car that will meet your needs and your budget if you look. We did. Ann and I have been interested in electric vehicles for a long time, since the mid-1990s. Our first electric car was a conversion, and then we leased a Nissan Leaf, and then we bought a used Tesla Model S. And we couldn't be happier with that transformation. So once you go electric, you'll never go back. There are so many advantages. Some of them were mentioned. In the 4 years that we leased our Nissan Leaf, we estimated we saved almost $3,000 in fuel and maintenance costs. We've had our used Model S for about almost exactly a year. And we figure that we save about $200 a month in fuel costs compared to a 30 mile per gallon vehicle that we would drive the same amount of miles. The only problem with our Model S is that we like it so much and we drive it so much that we're putting a lot of miles on it. So I think that once people understand the benefits, and then you get to the environmental benefits, it's pretty hard to gas up our second vehicle that we use to tow our sailboat now because of the fumes involved and the cost. You just cringe every time you do it. So you learn those things. Another question was, what state policies would advance electric vehicle use? And I think primarily at this early stage of adoption of electric vehicles is to restore the initial incentives that we had when we started buying electric vehicles. It used to be that all electric vehicles were sales tax exempt, and that was a pretty big deal when you're buying an expensive car. Now, only the first $43,000 of a purchase is sales tax exempt. And that exemption is going to end when a certain number of vehicles get sold. Yikes. If we want people to adopt this technology, we need to give them some incentives. And why should we do that? Why should the rest of the public basically subsidize us purchasing electric cars? Because as an electric car owner and driver, you are providing a public service. You are providing clean air for all of us to breathe. You are providing less noise in our roadways. So, you know, there's advantages. You're keeping our fuel dollars here when we buy electricity instead of buying gas that's made somewhere else and maybe the oil came from overseas, although that's diminished quite a bit lately. So there's some reasons why electric vehicle use should be incentivized by the public because we provide public service. And then the last one, if we drive long distances, what do you say to someone who has range anxiety? Well, the first thing I would say is get a bigger battery. But basically, be committed to driving electric, and you can make it happen. It's not going to be as fast as just blazing through and going 600 miles a day or whatever. But you can make it happen, even in a small battery electric vehicle. And also, use the available technology. PlugShare is a great app. There's a phone app that you can identify all the charging stations on your route. You can even see the comments that people have left about whether the station is working or not. And that's really helpful. So you can make it happen if you're committed. And one of the side effects of doing that, stopping every couple hours to charge, is you get to enjoy the journey better. It's not just about getting to the destination. Suddenly you're stopping in this little town. It's like, oh, look at that. There's a little park over here. And look at this little history walk. I never knew that was there. You know, I drove through here for 15 years. And suddenly you learn these things. And you make contact with other people. Go to the local store. I'm using the electric vehicle charger down the road. Oh, great. You know, well, that paid off, and we paid for that, didn't it? Somebody came here and spent their money. So you can definitely travel anywhere you want to, even in a small battery electric car. And as larger battery electric vehicles become available, like the Chevy Bolt that the dealership just drove up here tonight, that was really a pleasant surprise to see them drive up and a nice new shiny Bolt that has 238-mile range, EPA estimate. You know, there's cars available that can get you where you want to go. So I urge you all, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Let's create the one we want to see. Thanks.
So again, I'm Steve Wright from the PUD. First of all, I want to say thank you to Michael for being here. So PNNL is a crown jewel that is kind of hidden. A lot of people don't know it's there. We've been trying to increase our relationship with them because they do all kinds of cool things. You saw a piece of what they do tonight. They're helping us with cybersecurity issues, with smart grid issues, all kinds of things. So it's really wonderful to have you up here, Michael. So electric vehicles, you can't go to a conference around electricity these days without having a big part of the discussion engage electric vehicles. And the reason is because in our business, most of my career, it was driven by what's called least cost planning to meet load in a reliable fashion. But in the last 10 years, it's changed, and policy is now driven by how do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It is the number one priority. It what drives costs, it drives decision making with respect to what kind of resources, generating resources, utilities will buy. And fundamentally, it's because there are four pillars out there to a pathway to deep decarbonization. The first is you do all the energy efficiency you can do. The second is you decarbonize the electric system. The third is you electrify lots of things that are not electrified today. Vehicles, buildings are the biggest ones out there. And then you take the remaining energy use out there that's usually liquid fuels that don't work very well to electrify, and you try to get the carbon content of those to be as low as possible. So what happens is we are now having a discussion about if electricity is going to be the cornerstone of trying to achieve our deep decarbonization goals, what's going to be the least cost path in order to be able to make that happen? Least cost path for greenhouse gas emissions reduction. Because if you're going to try to electrify a bunch of other sectors, you want the electricity cost to be as low as possible, right? Because if you're going to try to pull people off of other fuels, then you want to keep that cost as low as possible. That means you need to make the decarbonization strategy in the electricity sector as low a cost as possible. Certainly the hydro system is the great opportunity area here. Energy efficiency, huge opportunity area here. And one of the big things that's going to happen, won't affect Chelan County that much, is we're going to find ways to be able to shut down the coal plants in the region. There's almost no doubt in my mind about this. You cannot achieve the goals without shutting down the coal plants and replacing them with energy efficiency, renewables, and probably some natural gas in order to maintain reliability on the system. So we've got this big change coming, and really a radical change in the electric sector, which ultimately potentially has some big policy implications for Chelan County and for the state as a whole. So first of all, let's just talk for a moment about Chelan County. If we are going to put in place a lot of renewable resources, and we're trying to figure out how to make that work, we will add a whole bunch of solar and wind to the electric power system in the West. And this changes things in a way that, candidly, those of us that have been in the industry for a long time, just turns the world upside down. Because what we've been accustomed to for a long time is that the time when energy is the most expensive is during the day, especially at night, because that's when people use electricity. Right? We use it during the day, we go home at night, we turn everything on, we're on for a few hours, that's the peak hour, and that the peak hour is the most expensive hour. So if you have a lot of wind, and particularly a lot of solar operating in the system in the West, you flip that upside down, because the solar is only available during the times when the sun is shining. So you produce a lot of solar from 6 o'clock in the morning until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, when you're producing all that solar, now you have this thing called net load. Net load is the amount of load on the system minus the variable energy resources, which are solar and wind. And all of a sudden, the net load, the peak, is now at nighttime, not at daytime. So why does that make a difference? Because we've been trained over the last couple of years, as we think about electric vehicles, that what we will do is charge our electric vehicles at night, because that's when the energy is the cheapest. And for 60 years in the electric power system, that's the way it has worked. 5 years from now, that's going to be completely different. We've already begun to see it in terms of the prices in the Western power market. So the way things are going to work in the future is going to be that energy is going to be the cheapest during the daytime hours. And when we're going to want to charge our electric vehicles is during the daytime hours, not the nighttime hours. In fact, today, we have many hours of the year in which electricity is priced at a negative price on daytime hours. What is a negative price? It means I, as a generator, have to pay you to take the electricity. You, as a user, actually get paid to use electricity, if we can make that translation from the wholesale market to the retail market. So how would we do that? Well, that would take a change in policy. Because today, when we charge you for a kilowatt hour, we charge you the same rate for a kilowatt hour pretty much no matter what hour of the day you use it. With, of course, the exception for our bus fleet, which we charge more for when you use a lot in a particular moment. We will need to think about how we charge in the future. Should we change to go to some sort of time of use rate in order to encourage more usage of electricity at the times when it's cheapest in the wholesale market? Would that make sense for us to do? Absolutely. It would make a ton of sense for us to do, because we make costs follow cost causation. That's when costs are lowest. That's when we should get to a point is where you can actually see that. Do we want more electric vehicles on this system? Absolutely, if you're in Chelan County. Because if you're in Chelan County, we are a net seller into the market. And generally, electric loads in the Western United States, in fact, across the United States as a whole, have been flat the last couple of years. They have not been growing. If you're a net seller, you want there to be higher demand. Higher demand is higher prices. Higher prices means we make more money. And of course, all of your rates are subsidized by the revenue that we get from making wholesale sales. So higher demand on this system is a good thing. More electrification of vehicles, the better it's going to be for the residents of Chelan County. So we have some really significant changes coming, I think. We do have a tremendous low-cost opportunity here. We have a carbon-free resource that can be sold into this marketplace and create some real value. We are very interested in trying to figure out ways to be able to get electric vehicles to go forward because, number one, it's good for society. It's a very low-cost resource in terms of GHG emissions, lower cost than many of our other alternatives. So it's good from a societal perspective. And ultimately, it's going to be good in terms of rates for Chelan County ratepayers. So with that, we're going to now open it up to take your questions. Please. Do we see anyone put fast chargers in parks? Yes, actually. So we have chargers in parks, but not fast chargers right now. The biggest problem with fast chargers is they're really expensive. They're substantially more expensive than slow chargers. And so you've got this return on investment problem, and especially with our relatively low rates. We also have a problem that we're going to have to work through over the course of the next couple of years. Because, again, if you're a Chelan County resident, your rates are subsidized today substantially by the wholesale revenues. So imagine for a moment if someone brought a very, very large battery from the west side of the state, came over here and charged that battery with our subsidized power and then took it back to the west side, how we would feel about that. most people would say, well, wait a second, that's not going to work out very good for us because that's taking our lower rates and just moving it someplace else. So we're going to have to figure out a way to charge probably differently for a residential homeowner versus a charger that sits in one of our parks. Another one of those big policy issues we've got coming in the next couple of years. Others?
For Dr. Meyer, with this growth of electric vehicles and batteries, is there anything being done so that as these batteries are recycled or disposed of, they will be doing that in an environmentally very friendly and economic way as opposed to what we've been for the last 30 years with technology?
Very good question. So from a sustainability perspective, it's an absolutely must. So we're seeing that lithium-ion batteries are already being collected. Those are the ones from your cell phone. In the olden days, you know, the cell phone had an easy snap of a batteries there. Now it's all incorporated, so it's and actually lasts longer. But I think the model here will probably be the lead-acid battery that you currently have in your car. So if you go and change the lead-acid battery in your car, it will be recycled to about 98%. So there's very little that will be actually thrown away. So even if you go to a Costco, you know, you're being charged unless you bring the core back. And so I think we will see the same mechanism being applied either through regulation. It's not quite clear whether it's cost effective. But lead acid battery recycling is also not cost effective, it's regulated.
And the technology of the batteries have changed dramatically. The batteries in our full size coaches are lithium ion iron phosphate design battery. Two things there. One is the manufacturer will buy them back from us when we retire the bus because they need to have high energy to move the vehicle. 12 years, 13 years old, they still have 85% of their capacity. They'll put them into stationary power applications, put them at the bottom of the windmill so that they can store the power because they'll work just fine for that. And they think they'll get 30 to 40 years out of it. So they've guaranteed to buy the batteries back from us at that point. The other piece is at least that technology. Nothing toxic in it. The electrolyte's drinkable, and the lithium is not, at least the way the chemical is put together, you just don't have the toxicity of it. They don't burn, they don't explode, at least that iron phosphate design. Now, other lithium-ion batteries have different chemistries and there's different heavy metals in them, but the one we have is very, environmentally very sensitive.
Thank you.
Rufus.
Michael,
question. Do you think the disruption or the real change to electric vehicles is going to be driven by government policy or by the economics? It looks like the economics of buying and maintaining vehicles is going to have a significant effect. Is it going to be a policy and a tax incentive piece, or is it going to be the economics that people are going to get at gravity? Okay.
Question. So number one is, I just want to... So baseline, the growth that we're already seeing is, it is already faster than the advent of the Priuses and the hybrid electric vehicles that still have internal combustion engine and are not plug-in. So that is happening already due to federal subsidies and then particularly through markets such as California, New York, Colorado, where you have an additional incentive. So we're seeing that the economics will actually really make the incentives in the mid-20s superfluous. So where the cost will be driven down so fast there, we're seeing already, so if you look at the learning curve of photovoltaic cells, right? So you're seeing it not so much here, but in Seattle, you're seeing a lot of photovoltaics roofs there. The cost have gone down tremendously. So we're talking about learning curve for every doubling of the production, you're cutting the cost by about 20%. So we're seeing that right now is in the lithium ion world, lithium-ion battery world, we're seeing about 19% reduction, very similar to the photovoltaics. And so at some point, this will really take off. And I think the price point for a compact vehicle will probably be, in, some people suggest somewhere in the $22,000 vehicle, sort of a comparison to a Honda Civic. And I mean, you look at the Bolt there, you know, the next generation might take you fairly close. So I think economics will win out. But in the meantime, I think you will see incentives are probably necessary to drive this up. And I think states, I mean, California feels very strongly that there's a business case to be made to have electric vehicles adopt in California, not from an energy, from an emissions perspective, that's part of it, but also from a business development perspective. Because a lot of the companies are settling down because they're seeing the growth there.
On your graph, you showed the accidental fatalities during a free fall at above the year 2005, 2006, down by over 10,000 lives every year. What was going on in our country that caused that?
I don't know. It's a good point.
Can I just do one quick check? Can folks in the back hear the questions?
The question was, on the graph, they showed this large drop in fatalities starting about 2005. And the question was, what was happening? Well, there were two things that were driving that. One was the full penetration of airbags. Every car had to have them starting in 2000. Second was vehicle miles traveled for the first time in our history as a country started dropping in 2005. So people are traveling less in individual cars than they have been. Now, that's turned around in the last 2 years. Started to see vehicle miles traveled go back up again as gas prices fell. But if you're traveling less, then the chance of being in an accident goes down. So those two factors really were most of the fatalities. Similarly, this last 2 years, you notice that was a little spike at the back. They're going back up again.
Just so you're all aware, if by chance you want to see Michael's presentation, you can find it. We posted it at our website, schlampud.org/EV. Pretty easy to find. Others? Right over here. Long-range wireless charging possible in the near future?
Well, where the technology is currently, I mean, probably not. So it was not possible to charge more than a couple of kilowatts wirelessly 4 years ago, 5 years ago. The loss in energy is significant. Our wireless charging that we're doing on our vehicles requires an 8 inches. We can charge it. It has an 8-inch gap between the plates that do the charging. They have a model they're actually doing for the Navy that has a 2-foot range because they're charging wireless drones underwater, so they can get a bit more range out of the wireless, but the inefficiencies go up. Logarithm based on the distance, so it's much more inefficient the further apart you go, and that's just basic physics. So maybe they'll figure out a way to engineer around that, but today probably not.
Yeah. So just to add to this comment is physics laws suggest that you probably don't want to do high transfer of electricity over longer distances because of the losses that you're incurring, and they go up quadratically as you're going further, so you're incurring more losses. Then there's also an issue there with safety. So think about you basically have a microwave there, and if a cat runs through, the cat gets zapped. Well, if it's just a cat, right? So there are these issues, but you know, there's technology there on the lower charging rate, particularly for cell phone. So there's some new directional charging going on, some new technology that MIT is developing. So if you want to look at this, Google MIT wireless long distance charging and you find more information.
Great question. Thank you.
So, actually speaking, how do you envision a built-out environment in, let's say, 10, 15 15 years when almost everyone has an electric car. And I'm thinking about the weekend from Seattle to Eastern Washington, the traffic on I-90, the number of the volume of cars, and finding, you know, getting charged again. I mean, what will it look like?
Well, I think the question in a variety of different ways. With the if we have the technology we have today, then I think we have a real problem. Because you couldn't have enough chargers, you probably couldn't have enough power to do that. What is changing is that's what I was mentioning about the battery technology, is the energy density in batteries is doubling every 4 years right now. At least, I mean, it's pretty darn astounding how far they've gone. So our 2016's batteries are 270 kilowatts. The 2018's, they've already told us they'll be 340 kilowatts in the same battery size. So that getting more energy density means those vehicles can go farther. And if you can put those larger batteries in the vehicle, I mean, not more the same weight, but actually in the same space, get a whole lot more range, then you don't need as many, you don't need the charging infrastructure at the pump. The other question is going to be fast charging, and that's also moving very quickly. Like I said, our wireless fast charging, that technology can be put to a car. The company that's building us this wireless charger is the company that's building the wireless chargers for Toyota. They are working on doing the same technology so they can wirelessly fast charge sedans. It's easier to do on the heavy-duty vehicles because we have cooling technology on our battery, so they don't have to worry quite as much about cooking the batteries when they charge them. And so they're starting on the heavier duty equipment. But that is absolutely the goal, is to have charging where you can recharge your vehicle in 3 to 5 minutes. So it's just like a gas station. That's the vision. Now, whether that's 10 years from now, hard to say.
I'd add one other thing to that. So I think it's pretty clear that there's a natural governor here in that the more charging stations, the more electric vehicles, the more electric vehicles, the more charging stations. It just keeps growing. We view the number one issue that is preventing a vast adoption of electric vehicles is the number of electric charging stations. And the thing that potentially begins to change that is the VW settlement. So the VW settlement is $2 billion that's now being distributed to the states. The states are deciding how to spend that. One of the most significant ways that can be spent and probably will be spent, because we're reading right into state policy, is to an electric charging station. So as you get those, then you get more vehicles. And the Shell company, Royal Dutch Shell, has now committed that they're going to start putting charging stations into their gas stations. So ultimately, you have to get to the point where you have as many charging stations as you have gas stations, or else you can't get to the big number of electric vehicles. There was a question over here, right there.
I think for all of you, what do your organizations do for educational outreach to really reach down to elementary, middle, and high school to get kids excited about the variety of avenues that they can do in their career?
At Link, we actually have a program where we go into every third grade classroom in our service area, and we have an art contest. But part of that is talking about what public transit is, what we're doing with electric, what public transit does in the community. And each of the kids does this art demonstration. That's what if you've ever seen the Link Pass, it's got a kid's drawing on it. We do a contest among all the schools to figure the art for our passes out from children. But that gives us an opportunity to talk about what those elements are and opportunities and both develop transit ridership as well as the environmental awareness.
Sure. Plug-in North Central Washington has displays at the Earth Day fairs in the county, and we try to educate people there. I'll have to be frank, though, that we generally are working on the adults. So we want people to take action now. And but we get a lot of kids. You know, tonight we had a lot of kids out test driving vehicles and or demo riding vehicles. So definitely the younger generation is interested and involved, and you know, we are happy to work with them and answer questions wherever we are. We try to have public displays. We had a National Drive Electric Week display in Wenatchee this year. Like I said, we do the Earth Day Fair in Chelan and Leavenworth. So And we have an event called Charge Across Washington where we drove a small battery electric car from Everett to Spokane, and we stopped at each of the chargers along the way and had a short public presentation for people to come and see an electric car and learn about electric cars and charging. So, but I have to say, we're generally working on the drivers right now.
Yeah. So, our institution, the and has been working. We are a founding member of the STEM school system in the Tri-Cities. So we have been active in the school system, going out, making presentations. What I must say is that, you know, funding constraints that we are under, those are some of the first things that, that will get cut. And so it's then up to individual scientists and engineers to do what Dr. John Holdren, former science advisor to the president, was saying is tithing. That those people in the know, you know, should go on the community and tithe their time, their knowledge. And I think it's probably very well put to entice the youth there to saying is, look, there's some new opportunities coming up and as I said before, they are stay in school and study hard. There will be some payoffs at the end.
It would be hard for me to tell you the answer to that with all the things that the PUD does. Every fourth grade student in Chelan County goes to Rocky Reach. We now have this year a program for K through three that's going into the schools. We run a STEM program for a week in the summer for some of the best students coming out of this area to go out to Rocky Reach and just focus on STEM activities. So a whole bunch of things going on out there, and we'd love to have you come be a part of that if you're interested. We're always looking for volunteers. Anybody in the community that would like to support us on that, come join us. Right there was next, and then I'll come over this way.
Well, we're going to see. and that sounds cute. I don't mean it that way, but our first generation buses have significant cold issues. And that's why they go out of service about the middle of November. When we were fast charging them, we had enough energy, heat, that we were keeping the batteries warm, we could run them over the winter. We had turned the fast chargers off, what we find is our range drops in half. The batteries are very temperature sensitive. That's one of the challenges. The BYD buses, we didn't get them in service until after the winter this last year, so I don't have enough cold weather experience to actually know what's going to happen with them. We've been given a warranty that if they don't perform at least at 85% of the capacity below 30 degrees, I'll buy them back from us at the full cost because it was a big concern of ours because of the experience on our earlier vehicles. Third generation vehicles actually have a heated battery. They have a chiller and a heater to manage battery temperature, so that takes that issue off the table. But they're very temperature sensitive, and they're very temperature sensitive on both ends. When we had the really hot summer where we had 6 weeks above 100 degrees, our buses were shutting down at 2 and 3 o'clock because the batteries were overheating. So, you know, they love us for the test bed because our climate is so extreme. We're exposed to vehicles to temperature ranges they don't see in LA and they don't see in Austin, the other places they've been running electric technology. So they hate my phone calls. So.
Now there's one over here.
I'm a math teacher, high school math teacher, and I've seen that kids need to learn their basics. They need to find that it's fun to do math so that we can get the kids that can go on. The problem I see is that there's a lot of kids that have come to high school that don't have the basics down and they can't move on. We need to find a way to make math fun for the younger kids and to keep those requirements up, to not have the calculators available when they are third grade, fourth grade, learn their basics, and then make it exciting. Show them the fun stuff that's coming that they can get involved with. I know they have some robotics programs now that are helping, but we need to find ways to make it exciting for boys and girls to move on in math and science in technology and engineering. I know I was kind of unusual because I was a girl graduating from high school in the 60s that liked math. I became a math teacher. Now I probably would have been an engineer. There wasn't the opportunity for me at that time.
I think the best thing we can do is just explain how things have changed. Our buses are rolling computers. Everything's programmed. I need electrical engineers more than I need mechanics. The BYD coach has 268 computers on it. That's a computer science function. And so what it takes to be a maintenance person is a very different skill. Now, we do have internships both with the tech center and with the college in the electrical engineering department to try to develop people, because these skills don't exist, because these are the first ones out there.
But let me take direct as a challenge there, and there you're back, and simply saying is, I'll give you an invitation to come to the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and bring your class along, and you'll be invited for a day.
I'm retired now.
All right.
But I see it.
But take it to your colleagues.
There you go. You got a taker right there?
Yeah.
That would be great. Michael's going to take back names. Anybody that over there. Thank you. There's a request to repeat the question.
Okay. I think the question was, are electric vehicle drivers paying their fair share of road taxes? Yes. We are not only paying our share, but we're paying more. Because I have to pay an extra $150 for my annual registration renewal for my electric vehicle. Part of that is for road maintenance, and part of it is for the state to install more quick chargers across the state. When we had our Nissan Leaf, we had to pay the same amount. However, we drove a lot fewer miles, and we were paying more than a person with a 30-mile-per-gallon car was paying in road tax. And this is one of the incentives that I think that the state should say, if we want to encourage people to drive electric cars, we need to not charge them for that. Because electric cars right now make up a very small percentage of the total number of vehicles in the state. So if they are helping the state, all the things I mentioned when I spoke, why not give them free ride?
So just to give a comparison, the average vehicle, gasoline-powered vehicle in the state paid about $140 in gas taxes last year. So the reason the legislature set the fee at $100 was to actually be cheaper than what the gas tax was on a practical basis. Now, if you don't drive very much, it's a fixed fee on an electric vehicle based on use on gas taxes, so you can get some variations in it. But that's the basis. The other thing that people need to be aware of is that gas tax covers about 48% of the cost of the system. And nothing is covering the cost of the rest. We're actually collecting a lot less money, doing a lot less maintenance, and our road system is just not.
Let me just add to this is, I think what you're seeing is it's a totally reform on the taxation as far as revenues is concerned for road maintenance and road extensions. And as it actually turns out, if you look at the causation problem, who is causing the biggest maintenance? Not light duty vehicles, it's big trucks. And so the taxation of big trucks is even more complicated. So I think transportation departments are really struggling. What is a fair way to collect the necessary revenues and the necessary taxes to maintain the roads? So there are new models are being thought about that is based on miles traveled, that has some components on causation for wear and tear on the surface. So there is the notion of weight classes, but it's nothing is chiseled in rock. And every state is struggling with it, and it's not a federal jurisdiction. It's done by states. So we're muddling and struggling through it.
So Elon Musk is now trying to put in a high-speed transport between cities to speed up that that process. My question really is, looking 10, 15, 20 years in the future, is that high-speed transport between communities going to change our overall driving habits so that we're more driving locally as opposed to long-distance station to station? Does that have some impact in terms of the efficacy of electric?
I think if you look at the history of...
See if you can just quickly summarize that.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to do that. I think the reality is when you increase speeds and access, what you do is you increase people wanting to travel. That's what the jet flights did. When air traffic got much faster, total volume of traffic. And trains got faster, car use got bigger. It's not necessarily, you don't actually trade off. You actually, it's synergistic growth. And so the potential could, you know, and that's one of the policy questions is how do we manage growth in miles? How do we create a future where we actually can move, because autonomous cars and electric vehicles and roads that have no capacity and not moving anyplace isn't buying anybody anything. So we need to find a way to make the system work better so that we still have mobility.
And back to the question there, is there any rationale that one foresees then human behavior that would drive in one scenario versus the other? I think the common sense by transportation scientists is that most likely with technology improvements, the vehicle miles traveled will go up. So it will be, you know, we've seen it with the deregulation of air traffic, that people are flying more often to Europe, flying more often to Asia because it was cheaper now than what it had been before. Traveling within our country more often, East Coast, West Coast, because it's so much more affordable. So will a bullet train provide something that's categorically different? I think it's probably one of those substitution processes where it might compete with short distance aviation. You know, if you fly from LAX to San Francisco, it's actually not worth really flying because you're spending more time at the airports than you're actually in the air. And so I could see there potentially that if the price is right, that the railroad, the fast rail system or that bullet train. Now, the issue with the bullet train is right of way because there is no right of way. So now you have issues there with property and right of way and issues there. I don't think it's a technical problem, it's more regulatory, jurisdictional problem.
So many of us get up and we drive our vehicles to work. We can sit at our computer and talk on our phone for the duration of the work day. And most of us these days with communication with fiber can do that at home. Why hasn't there or has there been incentive? You as a corporation, anything you can do to prevent your employee from being on the road, congesting the road, we're going to do something for you. That's certainly easier to make fiber than it is for concrete.
Sure.
I don't know if those incentives have been there. I don't think we have to be concerned about that yet here in the Valley. But
well, there actually are policies in Washington State. We are an exempt county, but there's called commute trip reduction, which is required of any employer that has more than 100 employees. They have to either find ways to put their employees on transit, telework, reduce parking. There's a variety of strategies that they have to go after those issues. and that's mainly Puget Sound, Vancouver, and Spokane is covered by that. Smaller counties are exempt from those requirements. And that may change going forward. This is very common in California. When I was down there, we had all sorts of commute trip reduction requirements on employers. However, telework has expanded dramatically. It's actually not growing very fast lately. A lot of companies are reversing. What they're finding is there are synergies that you gain face-to-face that you just don't get on technology. IBM has canceled all telework sites for themselves. They're requiring their people now to come into offices because they said the impact on efficiency was such. And that was what we were seeing when I was in LA before I came up here, was that companies were starting to shift away from it. They didn't see they couldn't see the benefits of using other strategies. But that question of employers, it actually is state policy, and it is the law in California, and it's the law urban counties here.
I moved here last week from Dark. I love it here. I'm glad I moved here. But I did work a number of years for corporations that did pay me to take the bus or the train. It was one of the incentives that I hired.
Well, and our federal government provides a bus pass for any federal employee. So our Forest Service employees here, all, you know, they can get a free bus pass on our system, and there's several other employers who do the same thing. So even where it's not mandated, there's agencies that are doing that.
The statistics that Michael had put up very early in looking at, you build the infrastructure to get more and more, and I say fortunate or unfortunate,
Yeah, and so there is, you know, there are experimentation there, and you're seeing it in Seattle with the 520 bridge. It's a toll bridge, and it's actually based on congestion pricing. The higher the congestion is, the higher the prices go. So that has some ramification, and now people avoiding it, and they are taking I-90, and now congests I-90, right, because that's still free. So it's not really thought through in its totality. There, it gives you these funny mechanisms. But I think you will see is that people will make trade-offs. You know, what is it worth to be in traffic? And with, you know, automated vehicles there, you actually have an alternative. I mean, it's riding there by doing something else. So you may not forego the opportunity to network, to connect to people face to face, and yet their commute is not a drag. So we'll see how this works out. This is one of those, what I would say is in the automotive, in the transportation arena, one of the biggest human behavior experiment that we're encountering.
So let me say, first of all, as a panelist, it's really fun. I've given a lot of talks over the years. I don't think I've ever sat in front of a group that was so intensely interested in a subject as you are. But I'm a little worried about keeping people a long time. So why don't we go like a couple more questions, and then we'll call it a night. So Rufus, you have one? And you'll be next over there.
What's the, Michael, put your crystal ball on. In 2030, what are going to be the major transportation issues here in our valley, or what's going to shift big time, you think, based on what you've seen and trend line?
Well, I think it's primarily driven by, I think, by population. So now if you tell me, if you shed some light into my crystal ball and tell me what the population will be, maybe the...
But I'm thinking more of like ownership of vehicle. So do you see those sort of that changing the...
Yeah, so we're seeing there that the demographics is basically bifurcating there. You know, it's the baby boomers like to have their vehicle. So if you talk to BMW, asking them is, do you see transportation as a service as a reality? They'd say it's no way. You know, our owners of a BMW, they love the car. They don't want to give it away to anybody else. They love their car. You know, that is one customer segment, but you will have probably much more diversified. So the younger folks, they may not really need to have their own personality in the car. You know, for them, it is just yet another service. and they're seeing the advantages of not owning a car, not checking the tire pressure, not bringing it in for servicing, and not paying taxes. Just pay for them like Uber, right, on your cell phone. So it's not quite clear how these demographics that will drive the behavior, but with everything that we have seen so far, is probably there will be a spectrum of different behaviors. So not necessarily one behavior, but probably a whole spectrum.
I'll just add to that, there's just no way to achieve the greenhouse gas emissions goals without a ton of electric vehicles, and you got to charge them. So you've got to come up with a charging infrastructure, and it's probably about where your car is going to be during the day.
Now just a remark, on one of your slides, you were showing an aerodynamic truck, a train of trucks, and it struck me because know today that one ton of freight travels 400 miles per gallon today, in fact, whereas with a truck it's about 12 miles. So I don't see the advantage of promoting even aerodynamic trucks with such appalling performance.
I think, although you have to recognize that our rail infrastructure just isn't capable of handling the volumes that are out there on a timely basis. And
today.
Well, today.
We're but talking about the future.
I agree.
If you look at all the other civilized countries, their train system, Japan, China, Europe, you find that the goods are moved by train into a city.
And there, trucks
distribute the goods. Why not have a system like that, rather than the biggest drag is with the tire on the road.
Well, the challenge is the economics of it. It's the infrastructure costs for rail are very expensive. It's very efficient. It can be very efficient. It's not necessarily as efficient as it sounds. It works great for bulk shipping. Numbers work exactly for bulk, but moving things like electronics, moving things like fruit, perishables, don't work quite as well on rail because the infrastructure is so weak. And the cost of adding infrastructure is really, really expensive to the point that the railroads have not been willing to do it. The European systems and the Japanese systems were, to a great degree, built by their governments because they made a decision they wanted that technology. So it wasn't entirely privately funded like our system is. So if we want to see a future where rail is a much bigger place, that means we need to have governmental subsidies put into this, or we need to tax trucks a lot more. I mean, you have to change the economics of it. I just think that's the reality of where you need to go is you need to change the economics. Right now, trucks are cheaper to the shipper than rail.
One last question, right here.
One comment there is population density. Big difference. Where we're spread here and Europe, Japan, highly dense population.
And that's also governmental policy. I mean, I don't mean, I'm never harping that. I mean, I don't live in the center of the city either, so I'm not saying those issues, but I was born in Germany, my family's from there. They don't allow suburbanization. The city limits are the limits, and they go up, they don't go out. And that is policy choices that have been made. We like our suburban development. That's something that Americans have chosen, and our government reflects that. That is a different environment. And that's, so trying to impose a solution that works someplace else is exactly right. You have to look at those other elements to it, and I think we need to develop our own solution that makes sense for the lifestyles and things we have. And they're not going to be the same answer. There may be elements of it, and there are things we can learn from other people. But we also need to recognize our built environment is very different, and it's built differently to a great degree because we like what we have.
Thank you so much. I think we've really appreciated you being here tonight. I'm sure our panelists will hang around a little bit. If you have additional questions, come on up.
Yeah, you are a